Direct RF detection in some of those cables because of the way they build the front ends of those things. That's another possibility. But, you know, it's not the direct TV part of it. It's something after that.
I agree with you. And it's going to take some work for them to try to do it in the neighbor's house is tough. And Mel's suggestion of unless you're super friendly with that neighbor, don't touch anything. Try to do a visual inspection and gather information. Maybe even operate a handy-talkie in their house to get some clues, a two-meter handy-talkie. But like Mel said, the smartest thing to do is you point to that and say, gee, that connection doesn't look good. I recommend you have your service person replace that particular piece of cable if it could be leaking and allow this problem to take place. Back to you, I guess it's Rich.
Where's the guy?
Yeah, guy. Yeah, that don't think this is going to happen. These people just built their house. They just moved in. They probably think everything is perfect. They just got brand new flat screen TVs on the roof. And when I go over to my satellite mode or my 10 meter mode, it's like disastrous. So I can't even go on those bands. Satellite, I gotta operate vertically. If I operate horizontal, I destroy everything. And even at 10 watts, I could see in my own house, you know, okay, cables are relatively close, so this and that. I'm using all LMR 400. All my connections are standing, I know they are. And everything is grounded well, and I'm still getting it.
WB2HWW.
How we recognize the link?
Go up higher. You may have it too close, and you may have a high field in the area. Get the antenna as high as you can above the roof.
Yeah, let's find out about that one, guy. What's the difference in altitude and location of your vertical antenna and your big wheel antennas?
About 10 feet between the two of them in elevation.
Yeah, and what's the horizontal translation?
Different parts of the roof. One of them is actually right next to the, right underneath, one of them is right over my satellite dish. Right, so that one I could see. That's my 10 meter inverted V. That I could see. But the, my twin loops for the satellite is, you know, on the other side of the roof, way above, it's on the other side of the chimney, so I don't think it's getting to that whatsoever that way.
Hold on, how is your roof antenna above the roof itself, physically above the roof?
Horizontal is 9 feet. 9.5 feet. The wheel antennas are about 15 feet and my vertical is about 23.
Okay, there's your answer. At 9 feet, you're about a quarter point away.
Somebody got a clean copy on that?
Yeah, Howie, you were very noisy on that one. However, what he's really saying, though, is take those loop antennas, the horizontal polarized antenna, get it higher. Put it at the same altitude with some kind of a outrigger or whatever. Put it at the same altitude where your vertical is. The higher up the antenna is, the further away it is from the hardware that's being used by these television systems, the better off you're going to be. So, you think it's horizontal versus vertical. I think it's really location versus location. That's what Howie's saying, that's what I'm hearing. I've got a quick question for Eric. Eric, the new digital sets, do you have reason to believe they are more, less, or the same in vulnerability to front-end overload and TVI. KE2EJ, KE2IW, and TechNet.
Comment? Okay. Actually, we've seen tests that are really sensitive to having stuff overload the front end. And with the newer stuff that we've been testing, I can put my HP right over it, the thing doesn't bother it. There's different things. But I also think I heard the other gentleman saying that on his satellite antennas he's got a tuna entering antenna at the same time. But the newer sets, believe it or not, Dick, are very, very good. Like, I have a particular problem where that I like to tune into channel 28, and it's the digital. We've got a channel 27 on the same tower, and most receivers, it wipes it out. But I've got one of the new receivers, and it doesn't have a problem with it. K2RWK,
so if I understand you correctly, you're operating a channel 28 receiver in the same building where 27 transmission is taking place. So 27 transmission is taking place in a building, and in that same building you can operate a 28 channel receiver if it's a good modern brand name, and the thing will fly without being interfered with. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's what you're hearing. On a tower, there's a translator. That's a kilowatt. It's maybe about 600 watts, 800 watts peak sync power. I've looked at it with a fine-tooth comb, but within spec, the side lobes are down where they belong. And on most digital receivers, they won't pick it up because it just bangs into it and swamps the front end of it. The receivers, don't forget the digital receivers don't have an IF. Come right out of the tuner and they start taking data out of it. So, you know, you can't blame it on the things that you would blame it on in an analog set. The way most of these things are made these days, the INQ comes right out of the tuner. It's funny. But, yeah, that's what you're doing.
By the way, does the tuner supply a vector demodulator with a I A to D and a Q A to D? Is that what's going on here? A comment?
Yeah, okay. Sort of. What's really going on is, you know, because we still have to do the Salus, we still have to do the Viterbi, and there's a few other things that go on, but before all that happens, we've got to get ones and zeros. When you buy a tuner these days, it actually comes out as ones and zeros, and that in turn goes into the equalizer. And they can pick up the other stations.
Go ahead, Thomas. I have a 12-inch fluorescent lamp in my shack on the desk. And if it lights up, that's an indication of an RF leak. That's the best way of checking RF leaks?
Not at all. The amount of RF leak to light up a fluorescent tube is almost at the threshold of being a radio frequency biohazard. It takes a lot of energy to light up a fluorescent tube. Yeah, you can light one up with a Van de Graaff generator or with a Tesla coil. But RF-wise, a 12-inch long fluorescent tube, I could make the leakage low enough that you no longer light up a tube. That still could be a huge amount of leaking by my standards. Go ahead.
Well, if you had that lamp next to a mobile antenna when you're transmitting with 50 watts, would it light up?
Yes, it might. Depending on the lamp and how you hold it, yes, it might. But 50 watts out of a mobile antenna is a huge amount of leakage. It ain't leakage, it's real radiation, but you know what I mean.
ICOM 2100 in my mobile and with a magnet mount antenna, and I held this bulb 12 inches from the antenna and it lit up bright like it was plugged in.
Yeah.
Cool radiation, please.
Yeah, but that's real 50 watts or 30 watts or whatever. That's a potent amount of signal. I mean, when it comes to leakage, We're looking for milliwatts per square centimeter. We're looking for microvolts. The actual voltage on the fluorescent tube at the instant it lights is something in the vicinity of 60 or 80 volts. 60 or 80 volts per foot is something like 180 volts per meter. That's a huge amount of E field. So a fluorescent tube not lighting is a necessary but not sufficient. You light up a fluorescent tube on your leakage, you got a huge amount of leakage. The fact that you didn't light up your fluorescent tube on leakage doesn't mean you really saw leakage from my point of view.
KV2
IEW. IEW, go ahead, tell us your name.
Yeah, back here with Guy again with the TVR problem. If I wanted to move my 2 meter wheel, it's going to be in the vicinity of my 2 meter vertical. What's the minimum amount of spacing that I could put between the two of them? Even if I'm going to cut it real, real close, what's the minimum amount of spacing I could put between my vertical, or what's actually going to be my vertical mast, and my 2 meter wheel?
If they really are one really vertical and one really horizontal, you can co-locate them. You could make one around the other. Now, you've got some physical constraints here. But when I wanted to build a circular polarized Yagi antenna, I took a horizontal Yagi, which was 19 elements long, another horizontal Yagi, 19 elements long. I put the two booms together and held them together with hose clamps, made one antenna horizontally polarized, one vertical polarized. In order to make sure the elements didn't touch each other, I moved one an inch ahead of the other. But those two antennas were isolated from each other, even though they were co-located. They were sharing the exact same boom, if you consider the fact that the two booms are held together with hose clamps. So if you truly have one horizontal and one vertical, you could put the horizontal antenna, if it was a loop, around the vertical antenna and make it fly. They could be co-located because they're cross-polarized. In theory, as long as you get the geometry right, they do not couple to each other. Back to you, Guy.
Right. That's if I was going that way. One of them is a vertical, which is going to be looking at the nest. The other one's going to be my omnidirectional, which is circularly polarized and basically looking up, but it's going to be seeing the vertical because I can't get this thing as high as the vertical. That's like physically impossible. If it's within, say, 6-7 feet away, you think it's going to be a problem? And if it's going to be a problem, would it be a problem? It's going to be a problem on the wheel antenna because it's lower, correct?
You got to back up a little bit here. You said the vertical antenna is going to see the mast. That's not clear. Are you saying it's mounted to the mast? Does the vertical antenna have a vertical radiator with three little ground plane radials coming out of it, and it's mounted to the mast? Is that what you're saying? That's question number one. Question number two, describe the horizontal antenna to us. What does it look like? I'd like you guys.
My wheel antenna is an 8-beater 2. Basically, it's the 8-beater design that's commonly manufactured. There's a gentleman out there with an N4 coil who has a slight offbeat to this 8-beater, and he calls it the 8-beater 2. Tried it out, the thing works amazingly, but the only problem is I'm getting this TVI from it, from the transmit pot, from the 2-meter. I could move the 2-meter onto a different location on my roof, but it's going to be in the vicinity of my 2-meter vertical. The 2-meter vertical has three small ground planes on it, and it's basically going to be about that height. It's going to be about the height of the ground planes. That's about as high as I'm going to be able to get it. Is it going to create a problem? And if it is, which antenna is it going to be creating a problem for?
Let's see what Eric's got to say. Was it Eric saying he's going to come in?
That's Rich, L2Y.
Great, L2Y.
I have a Diamond S200 vertical on a 36 foot mast, and I have the M square 2 meter loop on about the same altitude, about 20 feet separation, and it doesn't cause a problem. But I would say you're only using one antenna at a time, and it shouldn't cause any type of a problem.
Yeah, that 20 feet of separation you got between the two could be 2 feet of separation and it would work. And yes, if you're transmitting on one and receiving on the other, of course you'd be getting some overload characteristics. But a truly vertical antenna and a truly horizontal antenna, very poorly coupled to each other. So depending on physical geometry or what the antenna looks like, you could mount them a couple of feet apart and make it fly. Thank you, guy.
At least a half wavelength apart.
I don't think even a half wave. In the case of those two Yagis that I had, they were separated by a 16th of an inch, so to speak, the airspace between the two booms. If they're truly cross-polarized, they can be co-located. And I built the antennas. In fact, last Friday I was tuning up an antenna where the horizontal element and the vertical element of the antenna were 1/2 inch separated from each other. And they were separated radio-wise approximately 20 decibels. So if you truly have cross-polarization, and if you're smart enough with the physical layout, they can be co-located. So what we're describing here, Guy, I think is more of a physical problem of how you mount them. The separation between the antennas, as far as radio performance is concerned, I think is not a problem. Thank you, Guy.
Okay, so you think that's my next step after the TBI filter, because I would like to keep it in the location and in the respect that it is in now. If I can, I'm going to have to move them around. I really want to. I'm going to try the TBI filter. If that don't work, then I'm going to have to reconfigure the antennas up there. I really didn't want to do it, but it looks like I'm going to have to.
Another quick question.
I'll be here.
I don't think the TBI filter is going to solve the neighbor's problem. I think your biggest solution to the whole solution all the way around is move that horizontal antenna. I know it's going to take a lot of work, but if it eliminates all this grief, it's worth it.
Really, 100% Dick. That, you know, that TBI filter, it looks like it's not even, it may just be direct RF into the TV. It's not a harmonic, low-pass or high-pass filter. It's not going to work here.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you had, say, a 2-inch steel pipe mast, 36, 38 feet high, with a Diamond S200 mounted on the top of that, how can you mount a second antenna on the same mast, like, say, the 2-meter loop, onto that same mast? How would you do it?
Assuming that loop has got some kind of a physical arrangement to it where it can be mounted to a vertical mast, and you mount it a couple of feet down from the vertical on the top, except for the extra wind load on this very whippy mast, a 2-inch diameter mast, 36 feet long. It's a fairly whippy structure unless it's got some guy wires on it. But if that horizontal loop antenna has some kind of a vertical pipe mounting bracket to it, and you can mount it 1 or 2 feet below the ground plane radials of the vertical antenna.
Okay, follow this. Sidearm coming off that mast, like the 2-inch pipe now, say 3 feet below the diamond on the top. You have a T with a sidearm coming off, say 2 feet, and now that turns up, and now you mount your loop antenna on to that. Would that be good? No, what I have here is I have a bracket that's 20 feet to the house, and then I have guide wires at the 30-foot point.
Well done on the guide wires. GUI wires, guide wires. But that sidearm you described, that would work like a charm. Thank you.
That would be 100% good.
Absolutely. What made you think it wouldn't be?
Well, it's going to be a problem with wind. You know, another piece of pipe coming up the side, coming up. And being the antennas are close to each other. But you're not going to be using the same both antennas at the same time. You're going to either be connected to your 2 meter vertical or your 2 meter horizontal. But I put my horizontal 2 meter loop on a separate mast about 20 feet from the vertical antenna. And it's about the same height, about 36 feet, and it works very good on 2 meter sideband. With the Mirage amplifier I've gotten to Canada.
I believe you. But you didn't have to mount it on the second mast if you didn't want to. With that sidearm, you could have put it on the first mast and it would have worked like a charm.
You don't even need a sidearm. They can mount it on the mast as long as it's a couple feet below the ground radio, you know, below the radio.
I agree with that. When you've got antennas that are cross-polarized, you can get away with murder when it comes to close spacing. The example I gave of those two Yagis, you could say they were separated, well, the booms were 1-inch diameter. So there are two antennas, 432 megacycles, with 12-inch long elements. The two antennas were separated by 1.0 inches, and it worked like a charm.
What about the loop antenna itself being close to the steel mesh? Because the instruction is called to mount the antenna on a non-metallic mesh.
It's a horizontally polarized loop being mounted near a vertically polarized mast. That mast, except for 1% of some kind of coupling, it ain't there.
I'm quite sorry you on that.
The mast, the 2-inch diameter pipe, is vertically polarized. The loop antenna is horizontally polarized. One does not see the other. And I'm not kidding. Your eye sees it, the RF does not.
Well, in the instructions when I got the antenna, it said not to mount the antenna to a metallic mast. So I had a 5 foot long piece of fiberglass. It actually was an extension for a marine antenna. And I glued a stainless steel threaded rod coupling into the end of the fiberglass and bolted the antenna to that and then clamped the fiberglass to a steel copper mast, you know, 4 feet below the actual antenna. And it works fine.
Boy, you didn't have to do that. What brand name of antenna of a horizontally polarized loop told you you cannot mount it to a metallic, vertically polarized mast? Did the manufacturer say those words?
Yeah, it was in the instructions. That's what I interpreted. It's M squared. It's in the HRO catalog.
I own an M squared horizontally polarized loop antenna. It's called a square loop, a squaloop. Is that the one we're talking about?
It's a square loop, about 12 inches by 12 inches. And you adjust the shorting block to adjust the SWR for the frequency.
I agree. And you probably noticed that when it rains, that antenna, the biswire goes crazy. Have you noticed that?
No. I never had a problem with rain or sunny days.
This is a 2 meter square loop antenna inside of a black plastic container. It looks like a horizontal wing, a wing that's parallel to the ground. It's a black container, about 3/4 of an inch tall, and about 8 inches square. Is that the 2 meter version that we're talking about?
Negative. This is about 3/8 aluminum tubing. It's in a square, but it's in two halves, and there's a shorting block. And there's a block where you connect your coax.
That's the old squirrel type antenna, Dick.
Now, why in the world did it tell him to not mount it to a metal structure?
Oh no, maybe could have played a detuning, but you know what? It really makes no difference. I've mounted squirrels and halos through metal pipes, and you know what? They don't care.
Absolutely. A vertically polarized pipe does not see a horizontally polarized signal or the horizontally polarized antenna. So, except for some physical difficulty, that should work like a charm. You didn't have to put that on fiberglass, in my opinion.
I just happen to have it, and it worked out fine. The way, because there's like a bracket, a piece of aluminum, about an inch by an inch, with a hole through the center, where you would put a bolt through to mount it. So I glued a threaded rod coupling into the end of this fiberglass, and put a inch and a half by 3/8 stainless steel bolt through that, into that coupling, and that's glued to the fiberglass, and that's 5 feet long, and then that's clamped to my mast.
I ask one question.
Go ahead, Alan.
That matching stuff, is there like a little piece of plastic, like a little plastic tube where the shorty bar goes to?
It's an aluminum block that connects each side of the loop. It's like two aluminum tubes, maybe 4 inches long, then it's bent, that goes 12 inches long, and then it's bent again about another 4 inches long, with an inch or a half space between each end. And the shorting block, you would move back and forth to adjust the antenna, tune it to the frequency.
Right, but doesn't one of those things go through like a gamma match? Is that a gamma match? Should they? Aren't they using a gamma match on an antenna?
I've never seen it, so I can't answer that one.
Yeah, you know what? One thing I do remember with the squalos is you had to be careful if the tuning stuff, the gamma match was too close to the pipe. If they make a change. Nick, I want to ask you a question, a safety question. You brought up the fact that if you could light a fluorescent light, that meant you had a lot of RF. I got a 10-meter handy-talky, like a Motorola MT-1000 that had a 12-inch piece of a 12-inch rubber duct. I could take a 15-watt light bulb, fluorescent tube, and light it up about 5 to 6 inches away. Would you agree? Would you think kind of safe
to use
a handheld on 10 meters?
Okay, you dropped out a few times, but it takes something like 65 volts across the tube to light it, something in that order. And you know how many inches the tube is, therefore you've got 65 volts per that number of inches, and you calculate that into volts per meter. It's a pretty strong signal. So, if you were using a fluorescent tube and you're trying to assess radio frequency biohazard, I think it is a mediocre quality detector. But if you're using a fluorescent tube and you're trying to detect RF leakage from connectors, it's nowhere near sensitive enough, in my opinion. Back to you, Howie.
I agree with you, but what I'm trying to say is this. I have a 10-meter handheld, okay? I could definitely light up a fluorescent tube. And I wondered how Motorola was able to, well, they probably can't do it anymore today. These radios were used by the Forest Service on 30 megs, 32 megs. I got one on 10 meters, and I can tell you one thing. I could definitely light up a fluorescent tube, and I could definitely get an RF bug if I put my hand on the metal toggle switch on top. I just wonder how safe you think that is for really using.
Hey, now, the toggle switch on the top of what? The fluorescent tube?
No, on top of the handheld. If you take your hand, and touch the top of the radio, the toggle switch, you get a nice RF burn. If sometimes you touch the bottom of the battery, you will definitely get a nice RF burn on 10 meters.
And this is a 10-meter handy-talkie you're describing.
A perfect thing. Think of like an MT-1000, or something like an old HT-200, that size, and the antenna is about 12 inches long. The rubber duct load is 12 inches long. The radio puts out about 6 watts.
Amazing. So you can get an RF burn from the package of the radio itself. Well, it makes some sense. because the counterpoise in that case is the case of the radio and the hand of the person holding it. You think the case of the radio and the rubber duck is the antenna, but the human being holding it is also part of the antenna. As I've told you guys a couple of times, when a person is using a 72 megacycle radio control transmitter for his airplane, it turns out a man standing up on the ground, standing on the ground and it's purely vertical, his body resonates at somewhere near 72 megs. You can take that radio control transmitter, when the airplane is south of you, and you aim your body and the transmitter in front of you, you aim to the north, and you'll have no trouble talking to that airplane, because about half of the signal is radiated by you, and the other half is radiated by the whip antenna and the box you're holding on to. Back to you, Harry.
Roger. Now, I don't think it's that safe. I don't use it that much, but it's kind of interesting. I have a 10-meter repeater on the air right now. It's not that, you know, you don't get great distances. You go inside of a car or you go inside of a building, you have no penetration. But if you're in a field, in an open field, you get 20, 30, 40 miles between you and the repeater. But as soon as you go into a building or you're in a car, you can forget about it. I've been playing around with low band 10 meters, and it's kind of interesting what you can do with handheld. But I tell you, I think the RF field is just, because it's a short antenna, it's not a long antenna, and plus the field is not being distributed, I don't think it's too safe.
You're bringing up the RF dangers of cell phones.
Well, cell phones work at a much higher frequency. In the case of the cell phone, the antenna inside the cell phone really is the antenna. The box itself you hold onto is not hot. That's the good news. The bad news, the antenna is right alongside of your ear. Well, Motorola and other companies are getting smarter. They're moving the antenna down to the tip of a radio very close to where the microphone is to get it further away from your head, because the RF energy that a cell phone can couple into your head, because it's only a quarter of an inch away, is fairly significant. There are lots and lots of people who would never, never buy a house next door to a cell phone base station. They think it's unsafe. Each one of those carriers at a cell phone base station is a few watts. And the closest your house could get to it is about 200 feet, and the cell phone base station antennas are about 100 or more feet above the ground. You take that slant range, and you figure the closest you could be on the second floor of your house, the closest you could be to that antenna, and you calculate how much radio energy can get into your body. Then you take the 0.3 watt cell phone, which is a quarter of an inch away from your head. Because of inverse square law, the cell phone is almost 1 million times more RF energy into your body than if you lived directly next door to a cell phone base station. You tell those to the people on your local zoning board, and they'll think you're crazy. So the cell phone base station is safe as all hell, but the cell phone is putting a tremendous amount more of RF energy into your body. If nobody worries about the cell phone, I believe the cell phones are safe. But if the cell phones are safe, the base station is more than 1,000 times safer, even though it's got this big, ominous-looking piece of hardware, and it looks like it could really do damage to you. Because of the number of feet of range and inverse square law, it is the safest thing in the world. KQIW.
I'm going to see what's going on with insurance. The liability insurance for transmitting antennas is skyrocketing because of this whole RF biohazard.
Quick words.
This RF biohazard is highly misunderstood. When it comes to internet research on almost any subject, internet can supply you a lot of good data. Almost every single thing that you can read on the internet on the subject of radio frequency biohazard is bad data. Almost all of it is bad. It's written by people who start off with an emotional opinion about RF radiation, that nasty word, and they associate it with nuclear radiation. And the only thing that's factual, traceable to the Bureau, and authoritative on the subject of radio frequency biohazard
is written by respected organizations in a peer-reviewed journal. 30% of all the technical information written on planet Earth is written by the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. That's a respected organization. And their peer-reviewed journal, Microwave Theory and Techniques, has some extremely good articles, not easy to read, but extremely good articles on that subject, peer-reviewed. You read every one of those articles, you find out the time the guy first submitted the article, the time the second time the guy submitted the article, and the third time he finally got it past all of the reviewers, and it finally got published. That's a peer-reviewed journal. Those articles are good. You go to a good library, you can read those articles. You cannot read those articles on the internet unless you buy the IEEE Explore service, which is going to cost you quite a few $100s. You cannot download the good data. You can only download the bad data. So anybody who does a radio frequency biohazard research on the internet is in a heap of trouble. He's going to get a lot of bad information written in an emotional manner that's going to give him a bad feeling about the whole subject. One of the articles that's on the internet going around and around and around is this article written by Dr. Liu, L-I-E or L-I-U, I think his name is. And a lot of people have tried to use that article in a court of law with a radio frequency biohazard case. And in every case, it gets thrown out. Even though Dr. Liu did a sincere effort and he gathered a whole lot of articles of other writers, it is bad data. KQRIW.
Yes. Even though the other station, but I agree with you. Dick, I know. I'm a member of the IEEE. I can totally agree with you on that. Now, it's just that from a repeater owner perspective point of view, I mean, it's getting pretty scary because people just don't understand. The liability is going through the roof.
The Communication Act of 1996 of our federal government states in no uncertain terms, in your town, in your county, in your state, in your country, you cannot, since 1996, you cannot deny the siting of a cell phone base station based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. That's your federal government speaking. That takes precedent over what you do in your state, in your county, in your city, in your town, in your hamlet. You can deny them because you don't like the aesthetics, you're afraid it's going to fall down, it's going to damage somebody in a windstorm. You can deny for that. You cannot deny because of radio frequency biohazard. The federal government has been studying that for 50 years. They are stating in those uncertain terms. They're not saying there is little risk, they're saying there is no risk. You'd be amazed how many people think they can deny antennas for cell phones. As we speak, the people in the town of Basel are about to have a vote in April as to whether or not they're going to force the antennas that are on top of the water tower, the cell phone antennas, whether or not they're going to vote to have them removed because of radio frequency biohazard, because that water tower is 200 feet away from the high school. They think they're going to do that. They're wasting their time. Because if they do that, the county will condemn the property and put the antennas back. And they will add a few more because Homeland Security has said that Nassau County, and particularly New York City, has a mediocre report card for the amount of radio communication capability there is there for emergency services. So you think you can vote that away. You can't. Federal government takes precedence. KQRIW.
Thank you, Ed.
Go ahead, Rich.
But the county or the state or the city or whatever can say you got to carry insurance for biohazard. Now, go try to get an insurance company that will write, will do the underwriting. Go ahead, the other states, the WD2HW.
Do I have it?
Got it, Rich.
Okay. The antennas on the water tower, 200-foot distance from the antenna to a dwelling or the closest human being, for instance, that's 100% safe. But now you have a five-story apartment building with a cell site on the roof. And the tenants are living in the fifth floor apartment. Right underneath those antennas, are they in any danger? Now, I spoke to someone who works for Verizon. And he told me that those antennas can have an average of 50 to 100 watts of output power. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Not like this.
But those antennas, if you take a look at them, they...
Speaky umbrella effect. There's a hell of a lot of shielding. Like, if I go from my repeater site, from where the repeater is, and I'm underneath the repeater, I have a pretty decent amount of shielding between the antennas.
Yeah, the antenna itself, Rich, is about 3 foot tall, and it's operating at 900 or 890 megacycles, where the wavelength is about 14 inches. So it is almost three wavelengths tall, vertically. Therefore, the antenna has a vertical beam width of around 20 degrees. So the signal coming out of there is a 120 degree wide, 20 degree high, beaver tail. If you could see the pattern of that antenna, it's a beaver tail aimed at the horizon or maybe slightly above the horizon. Those people in that apartment directly below are safe. I was made a little bit uncomfortable to have an antenna a small number of feet above your head if you're in the fifth floor apartment radiating the kind of watts you're talking about. Psychologically, it's uncomfortable. If they made measurements, and I hope they did, they would find that inside that apartment, it's very safe. Back to you, Rich.
Getting back to the fluorescent light bulb, that was just half a joke. But to really detect an RF leak, you would use a field strength meter.
The nicest way to do it would be a little loop sniffer. In other words, you strip back the center conductor from a piece of coax cable like RG58, fold it into a 1-inch diameter loop, and loop it back and solder it to the shield. And now you go holding that loop antenna near anything that you think that's leaking and put it into a sensitive instrument like a spectrum analyzer or a receiver tuned to that frequency. Call a field strength meter if you like, but a sensitive receiver tuned to that frequency with that sniffer will allow you to pin down a leakage very nicely. Back to you, Rich.
Well, I took an old SWR field strength meter. Pyramid made it, I forget the model. Has a little antenna you would screw onto it. And now I took that meter while transmitting, and I held it, went near an antenna, and it would start to pick up, the needle would start to pick up the signal. So it's working. Now, that meter was frequency range from 1 megahertz to 150 megahertz. Now, supposing you want to check 2,000 megahertz, like a microwave oven, that's what, 2,200 megahertz?
Now, first of all, that wouldn't do it. And what you described sounds to me like a very insensitive meter. If you operated a transmitter near a real field strength meter, and if you're within 20 feet of the antenna, you should peg it. If it's a real field strength meter. That thing may call itself a field strength meter. And for walking near your ham radio antenna and detecting that, yes, it's radiating, and yes, as I walk around it, I can measure the pattern with it. Okay, I don't think it's anywhere near sensitive enough for a real leakage test of the magnitude we're talking about. And 99.9% of the microwave ovens out there who haven't been modified by somebody, they're safe. Because the whole way the darn thing works, they do a very good job of shielding that little cavity where you put your food, because what's got to happen is that the radio wave in there has got to bounce 5 times off the walls, maybe 10 times, before it finally gets absorbed by your food. And if there's any leakage in that microwave oven, your food ain't going to cook. So the highest priority is to make it work so it really cooks your food. The second highest priority for them is to make it safe. And the way they're designed, unless you do something pretty ridiculous like put a piece of corrugated cardboard in the door before you close it, then you would create a leakage. But you separate the door that much, I'd like to believe the safety latch wouldn't allow you to turn the thing on. Back to you, Rich.
Alright, no, jam the safety latch with something. But if you, alright, so it was a $25 a meter. Alright, it was cheap. But, you know, I started to pick up the signal when I got near an antenna. Alright, quality equipment will work much better, I understand that. But if you had a quality piece of equipment, does the fact that it will operate between, say, 1 megahertz and 100 and 500 megahertz, and now you want to check something that's transmitting on 1,000 megahertz, will it pick up anything?
Accurately.
You answered your own question. If you're using it outside of the range where it's rated, you've got no information. Unless somebody goes and makes a measurement of the instrument, you have no way of predicting what it's going to do when you're twice the highest frequency it was rated for.
That's what I thought. So whatever the equipment you're using is spec for in the frequency range, if you go above or below, it's worthless.
Didn't say it's worthless. You just don't know what it is. By the same token, I can take a bird watt meter slug that's rated from 500 to 1,000. That's where it's calibrated. If I use it on 1296, it's going to work. It's going to read 10% high or 10% low. It doesn't suddenly die because it's a very broadband detector inside of that slug of a bird watt meter. It doesn't suddenly die. It's just not calibrated there. You could, if you want to, run a calibration curve on 1296. You could use a 500 to 1,000 meg slug. You run your calibration curve at 1296, and you can get some reasonable good readings out of it. So, but if you try to, you take that slug that's rated for 500 to 1,000, you play, and you make a measurement on a transmitter at 1296, and you want to make a pronouncement without first calibrating it, of course, that's pretty foolish.
All right, got you covered. All right, last question. Did you try that battery test with a AA battery that's fully charged and one depleted dropping on concrete?
Of course not. I did not do that.
That's cool.
Okay, you do that.
Go ahead, Eric. In the middle of your conversation there. Actually, the other kid has not a microwave, and they have a nice RFR meter. It's a device that actually reads in microwatts per square centimeter. And typically when any kind of RF field study is done, a device like this is, you know, you're talking $15,000, $20,000 device, which we had one stolen of. But you've got one probe that goes between AM broadcast and 2 gigahertz. You've got another probe that goes between, like, what is it, I think it's 500 megahertz and 4 gigs or 5 gigs. And the bloody things are accurate like you wouldn't believe.
You're saying the thing is accurate? Is that what you said?
So I'm saying that, yeah, they're so broadband, but they're so incredibly accurate. I mean, you put a spectrum analyzer right next to it with a, you know, a calibrated dipole as a frequency of interest, and they agree with each other.
That's very good science, yeah. I've used NADA radiation hazard meters. We had an incident that took place at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Oh, what was that now? Roughly 1990 is when it occurred, when a high-power transmitter was smearing a shielded room on the inside with a fierce amount of microwave power. It melted the flange on a piece of waveguide. And then that piece of waveguide, a flexible piece of guide, flopped down into the room, and the transmitter kept transmitting. A guy was looking at the screen of a spectrum analyzer. They said, gee, that's interesting. There's a signal full strength on the screen. It's a 100 dB display screen, and the signal's at the top of the screen. He said, gee, that's interesting. He then looked at the front panel of the spectrum analyzer, and nothing was connected to it. And he said, holy blank. And he ran over to the wall and hit the big red button, the panic button, and shut down the room. And that started one hell of an investigation. Who was standing where? How long were you there? And what do we think you were exposed to? It turns out it was a safe situation, because a guy would have to stand very close to that waveguide, stand there for 6 minutes, and Earth to be in risk, and we carefully interviewed everybody to find out where they were during the incident, and so it was safe. But the next thing I did is to pick up one of those radiation hazard meters from NADA. I had them turn the transmitter back on, and I slowly started walking in the room to find out what was in the room. And it was sort of interesting. As I walked into the room, I could watch the meter going up and down in cycles each time I moved one half width depth. It was a highly reflective room, and so there was a standing wave in that room that was really fierce. And so as I was walking into the room, I could watch what the meter was doing. I didn't get more than about 5 feet into the room, and I was about 20 feet from the piece of waveguide when the readings I was seeing on the NADA meter made me feel a little bit of, it was nowhere near a danger level, but I decided not to go any further. Thought you'd get a kick out of that, that particular incident. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little secret about the northwest corner of the Empire State Building. Don't stand there on the 86th floor while you're looking out. Take a look and keep on moving. There's lots of little dirty secrets that even the World Trade Center, when it was up on the South Tower, there was one particular spot. I mean, most of the observation deck was nice and clean. But there was one particular area that was 50 times the FCC standard, but nobody knew about that.
On the case of the 86th floor, what's your guess as to the milliwatt per square centimeter we're talking about?
Let's put it this way. I don't want to say.
Okay. I think you're saying you don't want to dwell there for 6 minutes. Do you think you'd be safe there for 30 seconds?
Yeah. I think you're okay with that. So you don't want to hang out in that corner. It's only one little, I think it's only like 3 square meters. 3 centimeters. That's, see, yeah, it's like 3 feet square. It's a meter square. It's a particular spot. And it just, you know, it's incidental. But I mean, if you add up all the amount of energy that's coming off the top of that building, and I'll tell you, some of the antennas are marvelous. Like, look, my antenna on my tower, I could have guys climb with that thing running full 60 kilowatts and get about 3 feet under the base of the antenna, and it won't kick off an RF meter. That's how cool it is.
Very nice. In other words, you got a real pancake pattern aimed out at the horizon and very little of it coming straight down. Okay, I think we're coming to the end of the repeater, almost at the end of our rope. Let me pass it over to Mel, my co-captain, and Mel, anything else you want to go through before we close down tonight? K2KEY, sorry to keep you up so late, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY, so a very interesting discussion as always. And we're going to get a little bit more into, we started to touch upon loops, again, experiments with loops and all. And I guess we can leave that for another day and some other things about some math, electronic math and all. Some comments, more comments from the emails. So I guess basically because the repeater will be shutting down, at least getting in depth in any of that right now, nothing pressing. So we'll let it go for this week, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY.
I'm going to give it the opportunity to read one if you want to. It's your choice, Mel.
Hey, well, again, I take the ones that seem to repeat themselves with a number of same comments that they're trying to coax me into writing a either a series of articles or a some kind of manual going through as many steps with the Smith chart step by step as we did in about 10 tutorials, going through them step by step again with expansion of any more that I possibly could generate and other instances because they found them very handy to just substitute in their numbers and use the procedures, step-by-step procedures, and also if I would also include all the different comments and applications of both rectangular and polar coordinates and the math that I use, the simplified math, but to sit down and write a kind of thing like this, I'm afraid people, the best thing to do is refer back to the past discussions and absorb whatever you can out of them, but I don't think I've really got it in me to really write a definitive, you know, whole dissertation on these subjects, Dick, over.
Yeah, that would be a pretty heroic effort. And people will eventually discover that the TechNet broadcast, let's call them broadcast, narrowcast, are being recorded and presented on an internet website. You can go to a website on the internet. A beautiful hand in New Jersey is recording them and putting on the website. I don't have this letter in front of me right now. And so you can review them that way. When it comes to good use of a Smith chart, the chapter 18, I think it is, of the ARL antenna book covers it awfully nicely. So the person who asked you to write an article on it, I hope he had read that chapter first, in which case maybe he would have the opinion that the chapter covered a good percentage of what you covered, and maybe another article on it isn't required. To write an article, as you already know, Mel, is a pretty heroic effort to get it all right with the diagrams and the spellings and the vocabulary and put it into words that the majority of people will understand. It's a pretty big effort. I don't blame you for not volunteering immediately. So, Mel's going to think it over some more. Okay, this was TechNet number 1130 of the series that began in September of 1982. Here we are, 25 years later, still there. Must be a labor of love. 73, you all. Try to be kind to each other. We'll be back next week and find out a few more things about what these electrons are doing. K2LIW, TechNet Landmark, we're clear.